That is a beautiful point to start. Johnny is here, and that's exactly where we're going to start today. So that was the perfect question.
Okay.
Okay, so welcome everybody to our third session. And this is the third session on the Satipatthana Sutta. Again today, I would like to begin with a few comments on other things. The title of the series is Buddha Dharma or Buddhism. Why am I using the term Buddha Dharma and not Buddhism? Anybody have an idea or a thought they'd like to share? Well, the path to truth or wisdom does not have to be the Buddha's way. There are other ways. However, the Buddha did travel the path, and then once he accomplished it, he taught and shared it from a position of compassion, we're taught, to others. For me, I shared with you a little bit about my background last week and having been exposed to Chinese Taoism and Native American shamanism and Jewish Kabbalistic mysticism in depth, and eventually returning to the original exposure of the Buddha's path. It was the way that I felt most allowed me to proceed in understanding myself, who I am, and reality as I could experience it. That, of course, meant I was happier because I was doing what I felt was truly in my heart. I enjoy many other different paths. I have shared with many people their paths, and I don't find any conflict, but it has to be a path that you find touches and speaks to your heart and allows you to actually be happier and healthier and better off. As I mentioned also last time, I feel very strongly about it has to be of practical application, otherwise what use is it? When I take on new students, Dharma students generally, I have them read three books. The first is either the Enchiridion or other writings by Epictetus, who was a second century Greek Stoic philosopher. The second is Love is Letting Go of Fear by Gerald Jampolsky, a psychiatrist who wrote this about 30 years ago. And the third is To Love is to Be Happy With by Barry Neal and Susie Kaufman, who are two psychologists who founded the Option Institute in Massachusetts. Very interestingly, none of them are Buddhist books. So the question is why? Why would we suddenly read those? And I'm going to let you think about that. I'm sending you now the names of those books. Everybody should have that in their chat. If they check in their chat group, you can look at those books and find them. But in a future discourse, we will touch on why those books. A little bit has to do with the question that we just started is the path to wisdom and the path to finding one's own heart is something that has to very much be in touch with somebody, oneself. It has to be something that actually is relative to our lives and to what we perceive as reality. If it's something way, way out there, some strange foreign type of a behavior pattern, it's not necessarily going to be able to make sense to us. Do we all understand that? Yeah. Okay. The other thing I wanted to talk about, and this goes to the core of your question, Quinn. There is a fundamental. A fundamental is another term I would refer to as a universal law. And that universal law is karma. So let's talk a little bit about karma. It's a really big subject with many viewpoints and perspectives. And what I'm going to offer you is just one perspective from one viewpoint, as I see it, is going to be my explanation. In order to realize happiness and end suffering, it is fundamental to follow the universal laws. And it is fundamental to understand that one can grasp and digest, first partially and then fully, that one's own state of being is totally dependent on oneself and on nothing else. You see the connection now, Quinn, to that question you asked? Now, that is karma. We all can experience pleasant and unpleasant experiences, physical, mental, emotional. However, ultimately, our states of being depend on how we respond and react to those experiences. It doesn't have anything to do with what happens to us. We break a leg, there's pain. a lot of pain. We can't walk. But how we respond to that experience of pain and breaking a leg is what determines our state of being. Understood? Agreed? It's very interesting how somebody will say to us, oh, that's such a stupid thing you just said. And if that person is a dear friend of ours, we may not even respond. If you don't like it, doesn't matter. We're still friends, right? But if that person is somebody who we don't know, we may get very offended and say, how dare you make that kind of accusation of me? And the only difference is our perception of who is saying what they're saying, which influences the way we interpret it. Now, it's not a simple process to learn and to be able to take control of one's own true happiness and well-being. However, there are tools, and there are tools that people have used successfully, and the Buddha Dharma is one of them. And for me, going back to what I said before, it's the one that I have used and experienced the benefits and feel very confident in sharing, which is why I do and why I teach what I teach and why I express what I express. In karma, it's very important to understand three essential principles. First is accountability. The second is responsibility. And the third is self-discipline. It's through understanding these three principles that we can realize our actions and thoughts and what they generate, whether they are wholesome or unwholesome karma for us. Why did I say wholesome and unwholesome instead of good or bad? Traditionally, the word in Pali and used by the Buddha to describe karma is kusala, K-U-S-A-L-A. The S is kind of like a S-H, or akusala, with an A in front. One means wholesome, one means unwholesome. So there is no moral judgment here as to good or bad. There is just a distinction between karma that will help you become clearer, happier, more balanced, and know yourself better, or karma that will add on additional things to block your vision and understanding of yourself. Of course, wholesome is karma that helps you understand better. Unwholesome is karma that is more confusing. No one else is responsible for our own happiness. It's very simple to express, but obviously, as we all know, it's not so easy to put into practice. We go outside, someone cuts us off, and we feel, oh, that person, how could they drive so recklessly? Well, it's our choice to respond that way. We could sit back and just say, oh, there goes someone driving recklessly, or we could say, how dare they drive recklessly? Or if we were perhaps of a different point of view, we might say, how wonderfully they're driving recklessly. It's all really up to how we view our experiences in determining whether we generate wholesome or unwholesome karma. And this is extremely important. It's really fundamental to the understanding of the teachings of the Buddha. Because if one doesn't accept that we have this essential responsibility, accountability, and self-discipline, then the whole thing starts to unravel. Again, I'm not saying it's the only truth, the only way, but I am saying it is one way that he experienced, I've experienced, many others have experienced, and it does work if it's practiced. And so we study and practice the methods of Anapanasati and Satipatthana to assist us in being able to start to understand how we generate karma. So far, so good with everyone. The other thing I wanted to speak about a little bit just before we started is the wheel symbol, because you'll probably see this a lot when you go on to your searches on the internet of various Buddhist sites. The wheel is a symbol that pre-existed and predates Buddhism. It was used in Hindu mythology, it was used even before that. It's also used in Jain images, which is a different religion, similar and contemporary to the Buddhist teaching. And it was used afterwards, and it is still used in various other belief systems. The Buddhist symbol of the wheel has several meanings. Sometimes it has eight spokes, which represents the Eightfold Noble Path. Sometimes it has 12 spokes, or sometimes it has 24 spokes. Eight spokes represent the Eightfold Noble Path, and the hub, the rim, and the spokes are said to represent sila, which is virtue, prajna, which is wisdom, and samadhi, which is enlightenment. The cyclical movement of the wheel is also important because it symbolizes a beginning, a turning. And so the first lecture we did once was the original, the turning of the wheel. That was the very first in our discourses, the Dharma Chakra Sutta. And the symbol of turning the wheel in India at the time also predates Buddhism, but it represented something of a new movement, like a new beginning. When someone's born and astrologically they have all these great signs, they are considered to be a Dharma Chakra king, someone who has a lot of power, who could turn the wheel and change society. And there was one king, for example, Ashoka, who was a very famous king in Indian history after the Buddha, who eventually became Buddhist and his whole kingdom became Buddhist. However, the Buddha, born into that position, decided rather than become a Dharma Chakra king, he would become a Dharma Chakra spiritual person, which is a Buddha. And so the wheel represents also someone who comes and turns a whole new eon, a whole new leaf, a whole new beginning. The various traditions also have different images. The Tibetans, the Chinese, the Vietnamese, the Sri Lankans, they all use the wheel slightly differently. But it's very interesting, and you can go and research this. But I wanted you to have a little bit of an understanding of what that wheel symbol is and why it represents and is used so often in Buddhist imagery. Did everybody get what we needed to review this time? Everybody saw it on Telegram? Yes?
I didn't even look, Oren.
Oh, okay. Did anybody else look? Or everybody's depending on me to be reading. Okay, we finished on contemplating the body and the body. What I wanted you to read today, for today and speak about today, was the reflection on the modes of materiality. Okay, because everybody found that in the source material. So since people haven't read it, I'm gonna let you read it. Sam, you can start since you were...
honest.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so Sam, go ahead. Let's start. The reflection on the modes of materiality, elements, dhatu.
Right. And further, obicus abicum reflects on just this body according as it is placed or disposed by way of the modes of materiality, thinking thus. There are in this body the mode of solidity, the mode of cohesion, the mode of caloricity, and the mode of oscillation. Obicus, in whatever manner, a clever cow butcher or a cow butcher's apprentice, having slaughtered a cow and divided it by way of portions, should be sitting at the junction of a four-crossroad. In the same manner, a bhikkhu reflects on just this body, according as it is placed or disposed, by way of the modes of materiality, thinking thus, there are in this body the mode of solidity, the mode of cohesion, the mode of caloricity, and the mode of oscillation. Thus he lives contemplating the body and the body internally and clings to naught in the world. Thus also obicus obicu lives contemplating the body in the body.
Okay, thank you. What do we notice about this? We're talking first again, in the very first sentence, we see just as this body, according as it is placed or disposed by way of modes of materiality, thinking thus. He's asking us to consider the functioning of the body, the different aspects of being in a body. There are this mode of solidity, that's solid items, right? We feel our hands. There's the mode of cohesion. There's something that holds everything together. There is the mode of caloricity. Caloricity is heat. It's interesting that they use this. I think they're trying to associate this with the traditional term in those days, but it really means generating heat. So when we eat, when we breathe, we have to participate in digestion, in absorption. We have metabolism. So caloricity really means metabolism, the building up of energy, and the mode of oscillation. Oscillation is really vibration. That means that there is movement going on all the time. In fact, we would probably qualify the beating of the heart as oscillation, something that's stimulated. There's also the flow of the blood that has to do with oscillation. There's also the flow of the lymph. There's also tremors in the muscle, muscle contraction, muscle relax. We could say that's also a form of oscillation. So the Buddha is asking us to pay attention to the different functions that are happening in the body. And he gives an interesting example. And I myself always question why he gave an example of a cow butcher when one of the acts of, one of the silas of virtue is not to harm living beings. So I figure that either he thought this would be the easiest way to explain to others, or even perhaps this was added perhaps later and not something that he said. We have to always keep in mind that we don't know if the Buddha actually said these words. This is supposed to be an oral history that was only put down on paper 500 years later. Supposedly people remembered correctly, but it seems a little bit of a contradiction. One of the prime silas or acts of ethics is not to harm living beings. And then we give an example of a cow butcher's or a cow butcher's apprentice slaughtering a cow, dividing it into four pieces. Then we have the line just before the end, which is very important. Thus he lives contemplating the body in the body internally. And I think what we'll do is if you go back to that picture I gave you last week, which is a repeated image. Thus he lives contemplating the body in the body internally, or he lives contemplating the body in the body externally, or he lives contemplating the body in the body internally and externally. He lives contemplating origination things in the body, or he lives contemplating dissolution things of the body, or he lives contemplating origination and dissolution things in the body, or indeed his mindfulness is established with the thought, the body exists to the extent necessary just for knowledge and remembrance, and he lives in independent and clings to not in the world. Thus also a bhikkhu lives contemplating the body in the body. So just a note for when you're reading sutras on your own, and if you look at the original that you were reading, and you see in the body internally, dot, 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 and then you see it continues and clings to not in the world. All that I just read is inside there, because usually it's already been said. But the initial reason for saying these things and repeating them over and over was there. So why do you think, does anybody think there, the Buddha kept repeating this? What is this paragraph constantly returning to? What's the key element here? Anybody have an idea? Nobody wants to say? Okay, everybody's shy. Eventually you'll have to talk. I'm being very generous now. Later on in more discourses, I'll want you to start teaching me. Essential thing here, contemplating the body in various ways, right? Contemplating the body internally, contemplating the body externally. Contemplating the body internally and externally, contemplating origination of things in the body, contemplating dissolution of things in the body, or contemplating that the body exists just for necessary for knowledge and remembrance and lives independent, clings to not in the world. This is being repeated because this is part of the essence of the Satipatthana Sutta. It's key. It would not be repeated if it wasn't a key essential part. So the Buddha is going through the Satipatthana Sutra or the My Sutra of Mindfulness to share various methods and various things that you need, techniques you need to pay attention to. For example, the very beginning was a short breath in, a short breath out, a long breath in, a long breath out. My body's breathing, my body is not breathing. I'm standing, I'm going backward. Remember before, deportment or postures. We're walking forward, we're walking back, we're leaning, we're sitting down, we're lying down, paying attention to all the sensations. In fact, there was a saying that I put on the Path to Wisdom daily sayings. I don't know how many are signed up for that. If you're not, welcome, let me know and I'll get you signed up for it. And it was a quote by Goenka, who was a great teacher of Vipassana. And his quote is, if proper attention is not given to sensations, then we are not going to the deepest levels of the mind. The deepest level of the mind is constantly in contact with body sensations. And I find that to be a very accurate quotation because it reflects exactly what the Buddha is saying in the Satipatthana Sutta. I would like to repeat what I said last week. One can tap into this methodology at any level. One can tap into it just for stress reduction. One can tap into it just to be happier. One can tap into it for therapy on a coping level. However, if one really wants to go deep and explore the nature of the universe, one can also tap into it at that level. It is almost, I hesitate to say this, but I almost could say that it's guaranteed to work if you practice, because we have examples before us. The question is, how do we find a way to practice this in our life?